All right, so we are in Exodus 21, and can someone give me a quick review of Exodus 20, what we studied last week? That's right. God gives the Ten Commandments to Moses, and we talked about how the Ten Commandments are like Israel's constitution. This is the base of their law. Okay? So God gives the Ten Commandments to Moses, but does he give it just to Moses? Who does he really give it to? That's right. God speaks directly to all the Israelites. It's not just to Moses up on top of the mountain. He gives it to all the Israelites. And what is their response? Yes, they agree to do all that, but they don't, right, they're trembling in fear. They don't want God to speak to them directly. They want Moses to be the intermediary, to go up and talk to God, and they want to hear from Moses. They don't want to hear directly from God anymore. It's too frightening. Okay, so at the end of chapter 20, it says, verse 21. So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud. Okay? So they were all at the bottom of the mountain. God spoke the Ten Commandments. The people said, no, we don't want to hear from God. It's too scary. So they then tell Moses, we want to hear from you instead. So then Moses goes up the mountain and God continues to talk to just Moses. Okay? And the very end of chapter 20, we talked about how God gives them immediate instructions on how to worship him. Right, they were supposed to build an altar, but it was supposed to be of earth. And if you did make it of stone, it was to not be of cut stone, so that there was no danger that you worship the altar instead of God himself. Because we talked about Ten Commandments, as soon as you make any representation of God, you start worshiping that thing and not God himself. There is no representation of God. Okay, so we have chapter 21. I'm have a long intro before we even get into the text because for a lot of people, this is a very sticky passage. I don't know if you've read it ahead of time, but this deals with slave law. Okay? And so then people are upset. Why did God even allow slavery in the first place? See, this is a wretched God. He promotes slavery. Whatever. Okay? And some of the laws, the way they are worded in English is confusing and is easily misunderstood. So a lot of times in these, I mean, I learned a lot. I would read something and be like, oh, that's not really what I thought it meant. Okay. So just a couple things introduction. This is the only part of the law that emphasizes slave law. Deuteronomy does not. Okay. When Moses tells the law a second time to the new generation going into Israel, slave law is not included. It is included here because Israel just came out of slavery. They were slaves in Egypt and they were redeemed. God saved them, God delivered them. So now God says, you were slaves, you knew how it felt to be treated unfairly. Now this is how you should treat your slaves. This is how you properly deal with slaves. Okay, so God gives them a new rules for a new kind of slavery, which we're going to see is very countercultural, very against the way slavery was in the ancient Near East. Okay, so two things to keep in mind while we're reading this chapter that we cannot do. One, we cannot interpret this chapter with our idea of slavery. Don't do it. It's hard to do, okay? When we think slaves, we think slave traders going over to Africa, kidnapping a bunch of people, bringing them over on these horrible conditions, selling them where they are owned for life, and their children and grandchildren, great, everybody is owned for life, and the master has all power over them and can treat them however he wants. Okay, that's our idea of slavery. Or even modern day slavery where a girl is kidnapped and sold into, prostitution or whatever. Okay, we have to throw out those ideas of slavery. We cannot view this chapter through our Western eyes. Okay, because that's not what slavery was like in the Bible. So we have to be careful that we do not interpret these laws through our ideas of what slavery is. Okay, the second thing we cannot do is we cannot just throw out the idea of slavery, that in slavery is inherently bad. Okay, in our culture, in our nation, slavery is inherently bad. We hear the word slave and we automatically think negative, bad, don't do that. Okay, but we've talked about the entire book of Exodus, right? Israel was saved out of slavery to Egypt, and they were saved into what?
Slavery to God.
Slavery to God. Okay, so they, and we've talked about this many times, they were not free, and we've also talked many times, no one is free. Okay, Paul talks about this in Romans 6, 15 to 23. He builds on this idea, right? We are either slaves to sin or slaves to righteousness. We are never free, okay? So the Bible never teaches that we are inherently free and get to do whatever we want, right? That's when we're free and get to do whatever we want and every man does what's right in his own eyes, who are we really slaves to? Sin, exactly. We are slaves to sin, okay? So we are either slaves to sin or we are slaves to righteousness. Okay, so we cannot interpret this through the eyes of Western slavery, and we cannot just say all slavery is inherently bad, because God teaches very clearly that we are either slaves to Satan or slaves to God. Okay. Okay. Question? No. Okay, so if slavery in Israel was not like our modern slavery, what was it? Okay, so slave, the term slave can either mean a worker, an employee, a servant, or a slave. So the same Hebrew term, avad, can mean all those things. So it can mean a slave like Israel was slaves in Egypt, which they being slaves in Egypt is more like our modern day slavery. Okay, but the term slave can also mean employee. Okay, a lot of us were employees, are employees, or our husbands are employees. Okay, so anyone in any of these categories, worker, employee, servant, or slave, came under the protection of Yahweh's covenant law. And we're going to see that his law really does protect the slave. Master, the term master, can mean boss, employer, master, or owner. Okay, so these are broad terms that have a lot of meanings. So when we hear master, we can't think of the Southern master that beat his slaves to death in America, okay? We can't just think that. It also means boss or employer. Okay, we're going to run across the terms buy and sell. Somebody buys somebody else, somebody sells somebody. Okay, but this can refer to any financial transaction related to a contract. So if you enter into a contract with a boss, the Bible's going to say you are selling yourself, okay? You are selling yourself into slavery, all right? So this, the buy and sell in our day and age have very negative connotations, right? We have to, when we read them, not think so negatively. This is entering into a financial contract is what it is, okay? In Israel, most of the slaves were under formal contract related to a specific job, okay, that they had agreed to perform for a specific period of time. These are, a lot of them were contract slaves. They agreed to do a certain job for a certain amount of time for a certain remuneration, okay? This is not going to be exactly like our employment today, because in our employment today, you get to quit anytime you want, right? You're paid weekly, biweekly, monthly, whatever, and then you just get to quit whenever you want, okay? So this is more similar to our military today. When you join the military, you join and you get a bonus and you get paycheck, but you have signed up for a certain amount of time and you can't just quit when you want to, okay, until you are, you know, till your contract is up, and then you're allowed to go free. So slavery in the Old Testament, a better comparison is going to be our military today. Okay, a slave could be a doctor, an accountant, a field worker, fill in the blank, any job. Okay, so a slave wasn't necessarily, being a slave didn't necessarily mean you were unskilled, okay, that you just worked in the field. It could be that. Okay, but you could also be a doctor. You could be an accountant. You could be a lawyer. You could be all of these kinds of things. It's just you have agreed to work for a master for a specific amount of time for a specific amount of money. Okay? Okay, again, emphasis. This is not like our slavery today. Slavery today, you have no freedom. You do what your master says for the rest of your life. Okay, or slavery in our history. God, we're going to run across laws that God clearly was against this kind of slavery. He did not allow the stealing of people and selling them to someone who possessed them for life. Okay? We're going to find that slavery could be so good that the slave himself would choose himself of his own accord to be a slave for life. Okay? To a good master. Okay, Israel's time in Egypt, again, was more like what we think of slavery today. But slave law, God's slave law protected the slave and gave them opportunities for freedom and protected them against abuse. Okay, there were four categories of slaves in the Old Testament. The first one, we're not going to deal with today because it was about foreigners. Okay, so the first category is foreign people whose lives were spared in war, okay? So Israel's at war with a foreign nation. Some of the people are captured. Their lives are spared, and they are allowed to live if they become workers in Israel. Okay, we're not going to deal with this today, but you can find examples of this in Joshua 9:23 with the Gibeonites, okay? When God had told them to go in and wipe out all the Canaanites, right? Well, the Gibeonites are like, well, we know we're going to get wiped out, so we're going to pretend we're from far, far away. Well, Joshua does not consult the Lord, and he agrees to their terms, and then when he finds out that they live next door, right, he's mad. Well, so what does he do? He makes them slaves, okay? But in the grand scheme of things, that is a mercy because God had told them to wipe them all out, so they really should be dead. But because of Joshua not consulting the Lord, now they're slaves. So that's Joshua 9:23. Also in 1 Samuel 4:9, the Philistines don't want to become slaves in Israel. Okay? So we're not going to deal with that today. That's a different topic. Second type of slave is a 6-year slave. Okay, these were contracted to work for 6 years in return for wages and benefits. Okay, and after 6 years were done, they were done. Now, if they wanted to, they could sign on for another 6 years. They could choose to be a slave for life, whatever. There were options. But at the end of 6 years, this contract is over. You are completed. You have completed your work, and you are free to go. Third, there were servants or slaves that were born in the master's household. So if your mom or dad or both are slaves and you're born, well, you are now a slave also in the household of your master. Okay, they are going to owe the master for room and board until they decide to leave. So they're going to be under some sort of contract as well. Fourth, there are temporary or permanent employees. So you could choose to be a slave for life, or you could be a very temporary employee like a day laborer. Like in the New Testament, when Jesus tells the parable of the master that goes out and hires the day laborer in the morning and then in, you know, mid-morning and afternoon and late afternoon, right? And they all get paid the same amount. You remember that parable? Okay, so there could be a boss or an employer could go out and just hire someone for the day, okay? And you were, quote-unquote, a slave for that day, okay? Also, one last thing to remember. In Israel, during this time, all businesses were small family businesses. There are no massive corporations, none of that. Okay, and all businesses probably included some sort of farming, or at least a family had to at least farm on the side. Okay, so masters or owners were people who were relatively wealthy, who had a larger farm or a larger business But remember, it's still going to be a small family business that their family cannot provide all the work. So now they need to go out and hire other people to help them. But because they're still small family businesses, all the family and all the slaves lived with or close to the family who owned it. Okay. So these are smaller things, you know, so we're not thinking of, you know, working for whatever, Google or something. Okay. This is small family businesses. Okay. Questions on any of the intro before we dive in? Yes.
The first one was we cannot interpret slavery today as it was back then. What was the second one?
Right. We cannot throw out slavery altogether. We cannot just make the blanket statement that slavery is bad, period.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Good. Anything else? All right. Can someone read for me Exodus 21, 1 through 11?
Shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. And if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is pleasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money.
Okay, so verse 1. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. Okay, so remember, the people were down at the bottom of the mountain. They don't want to hear from God. So Moses goes up to the top of the mountain. So God continues to reveal the law to Moses. Okay? And the law is going to be chapters 21, 22, and 23. Okay? At least in Exodus, right? We have Leviticus as well. But in 24, chapter 24, the covenant is going to be formally accepted by the people. Okay? This chapter flushes out command 6, do not murder. Okay, now the first section is about slaves, but the rest of it is going to basically be do not murder. And what do we do with murderers? Okay, and we're going to see that God values life and that God values all life equally. Okay, there is not one life that is more valuable than another life. Okay, he says, now these are the ordinances which you are to set before him. Before them, before the people of Israel. The Ten Commandments were the general principles. These are going to be specific laws that are going to further expound and clarify the Ten Commandments. Okay? Remember, we said that the Ten Commandments are kind of like the Constitution and the rest of the laws are like our federal law. But there's a big difference between Jewish law and American law. Okay? In American law, our laws have to be so, so specific, because if they're not, then the criminal can wiggle out in a loophole because you didn't specify the very specific thing I did in the law. Okay, so people get free even though they're guilty because it's not, the law has not been so specific. And so then what happens? They try to write a more specific law. Jewish law didn't operate like that. God is going to lay down general principles, and the judges were then free to extrapolate from that the spirit of the law. Okay, we're going to learn about what happens if an ox kills someone. Okay, well, but a person can't say, well, my ox didn't kill somebody, but my horse trampled somebody to death, right? You can't make that argument. God didn't make a law about horses. No, the same principle is going to apply. Okay, so just because there's a specific example in the law doesn't mean that it's only that example that applies. Okay, so the judges took these laws in Israel, if they were good judges, and then took out the principle from the law and applied it to specific circumstances. Okay, so it was more the spirit of the law now is being applied than, the law has to specifically say your ox or any of your other animals, right? God's law didn't work that way. You didn't have to. Okay. Okay, verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. Okay, so this is the normal contractual agreement for 6 years. Okay, you got released on the seventh year, and this should always remind you of creation week and the Sabbath, right? So even God's slave law says 6 years are the normal term, but on the seventh year he gets to go free, he's done. So again, the master or the owner, you in this case, if you buy a Hebrew slave, right, you have more work than your family can do, so you need to go out and get other workers to help you do your business. Okay? There are no rules on how the slave is to be paid. Okay? But the slave was paid. It's not that the slave wasn't paid, it's just there's no rules on exactly how you had to do that. Some would have received a lump sum at the beginning of their employment, which they then have to work off. Some received a lump sum at the end of their employment, and some might have received periodic payments throughout. Okay? Think of Jacob, right? With Leah and Rachel. He had to work 7 years for what he thought was Rachel. Then he gets Leah, right? And then he gets Rachel immediately, but then has to work 7 years more to pay off that debt. So it's like for Leah, he worked, got the payment at the end, and then for Rachel, he got the payment at the beginning and then had to work. Okay, so same idea with the slaves in Israel. Okay, the money most commonly went to the slave who, quote unquote, sold himself, right? So the slave is saying, I need work, I have debt, I owe this person money, I don't even have money to live, okay? Whatever the case was, I need to work. So he would sell himself to an employer. Okay, along with whatever wage was agreed upon for your 6 years of service, you would receive housing, food, and possibly even clothing. Okay, so your master took care of you like one of the family. For Israel, this was a way out of poverty. If you were too poor, you didn't have land yourself, you couldn't afford to feed your family, this was a way that you could make sure your family was taken care of, that you had a good job and could provide. Okay, just like our military today. People can join the military today as a way out of poverty because they will pay you, they will feed you, they will clothe you, they will provide housing. Okay, very similar. Verse 3 and 4. Okay, so this is where people get hung up. Okay, starts to be part of where people come up. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. Okay, that part's easy peasy. Okay, if you go in as a single slave and you leave as a single slave, no problem. If you come in married with a family, you go out married with a family, no problem. Okay, verse 4 is the problem. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master and he shall go out alone. Okay, in our Western way of thinking, we're like, how in the world is that fair? Okay, you can't just split up a family, right? Not fair to the employer, the employee. How dare God, right? This is just an awful law. Okay? But it's because we don't understand what God's saying. These laws, this law, verse 4 and then 5 and 6, these laws protect the worker and the employer when dependents are involved. Okay? The purpose of these laws is to ensure that neither the worker nor the boss loses what is rightfully his at the time of termination of the contract. Okay? So if the worker goes in single, he comes out single. If he goes in with a wife, he comes out with a wife. So the master can't say, oh no, your wife owes me more. Okay? The master can't steal the wife. If you come in with a wife, you go out with a wife. Okay? It gets more complicated when the worker, the slave, marries another slave while he is being a slave, while he's working. Okay? We also have to remember their marriage was not like we do marriage today. In Israel, marriages were arranged and the bride was sold to the groom. Okay? To marry someone, the groom had to make a payment to the bride's family to marry the woman. Okay, thus Jacob and Leah and Rachel. He had to work to buy his bride. Okay, and he got tricked into buying two of them when he only wanted one. So, if the master had a woman that was already in contract service for him, he could negotiate her marriage and he received the bride payment. Okay, because she's working for him. So there had to be compensation to him for the whatever costs he had incurred on her behalf. Her potential to provide children was also an asset, okay, and was calculated in the price, okay? So he had to be compensated for the marriage arrangement. So let's say the slave is on year 5 of his employment and the bride is only on year 2 of her employment, right? The law is saying when the husband gets to year 7, the bride's now only still on year 4. She still owes time to her master. She still owes service to her master. So she can't just walk free because she still owes the master. The master has paid for her. She still owes him money. So that's not fair to the master. Okay, so the male slave can't just take away the wife and the children because the children are also an asset to the master and owe him something for the what he has provided for them. Okay? So if the wife and children still have obligations to the master, the husband cannot just steal them away from the master. Okay? That's why he has to go out alone and he cannot take them with him. Now, the wife and children are not slaves for life. Okay? They have a certain amount that they need to pay back. And once they're done paying that back, then they can go free. Okay? So, a couple things. One, the slave, the husband, would be fully aware of all of this before he marries the girl. Okay? So it's not like, oh, year 7 rolls around. Oh, I'm going to leave with my family. Oh, surprise, I can't. Okay, it wasn't like that. This is clearly the law. So this is would have been taken into consideration by the husband when he gets married in the first place. Okay, also he had several options. One, he could find work elsewhere and wait out the contract terms of his wife and children. The problem here is he would have to find a different place to live or he would have to pay his master room and board. Okay. Because he no longer worked for that master. He was done. Second option, he could pay off or redeem his wife and children. He could pay off their remaining debt or their remaining work period. Okay? This would have probably been very difficult to do because if you're a slave in the first place, you're probably not going to have that kind of money. Okay? But if you came into it, you could do that. You could redeem your wife and your children and they could come with you.
Misha?
Yes. Right. So that might prolong her term of service, possibly. I mean, I don't know exactly how that worked, but that's a great question because, yeah, now she's taking care of a kid. But remember back then, too, children were viewed very highly, I mean, valuable. They were very valuable, and you wanted lots of children, right? Because you need lots of children to work your business. When you have children, now your children start to owe the master too because he is providing for them. And so it probably got pretty complicated and it might have dragged out, you know, the term of service for the female. Okay. But that's why God gives another option. Okay. The third option is if the male slave could say, verse 5, I love my master, my wife, and my children. I will not go free. So the slave could then choose willingly to stay with his master. This offered financial security for life and the ability to stay with his family. Okay. Remember, the people that are entering into this quote-unquote slavery voluntarily, they're people who need the money. They're people that don't have a source of income outside of this, okay? So his contract might be up, but he's either going to have to sign a new one with his master or go find work somewhere else, be a slave to somebody else. So it is a very viable, good option to just stay with the master you're with and be a slave for life, okay? Verse 5 and 6, but if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man. Then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door of the or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. Okay? This shows that being a slave could be a very good thing. Okay? And being a slave is a form of redemption. This puts on display for the world what it is like to be a slave of God. I love my master. If you have a good master and he is providing for you and you have financial security, it is a good thing to be a slave, right? And this is exactly what it's like to be a slave of God. So this option for this husband puts on display God's salvation and redemption of Israel and puts on display for the world the point of the book of Exodus, that God saved them out of slavery in Egypt to be slaves to God. Okay. If, and remember, this, the slave gets to choose this. This is not forced on him by the master. If the slave thought it was best to stay, he could do so, and then there was a ritual to finalize the deal. Okay, this ensured that the slave was not just making a rash decision. Okay, and because there's a ritual and a physical sign, the employer cannot be accused of not honoring the six-term limit. Okay, someone can't come and accuse him saying, hey, you didn't let this slave go after 6 years. So most likely, eventually, once the tabernacle or the temple were built, the slave and the boss went to the tabernacle and swore before the priests. But they understood that they are swearing before God. It says, his master shall bring him to God. Okay, so that was most likely the tabernacle and the temple. The piercing of the ear was a visual sign of permanent employment. This made it so that the slave couldn't run away later and go try to get work elsewhere, because they would see the pierced ear and say, you're somebody's permanent slave. We can't hire you. And it also reminded the boss that he is permanently responsible for this slave. Okay, this slave and his family now are your, you know, permanent employees, and you are responsible for them. Okay. Questions so far? Okay, verse 7 to 11, this is also another section that rubs us the wrong way, just with the natural reading of it. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Anytime we hear the term, a father sells his daughter, we can only think negative, okay, that this cannot be a good thing, okay? But the idea here is that the dad is out to get a better life for his daughter, okay? They're poor, they're struggling, they don't have the financial means. So what can the dad do? He can sell his daughter to a wealthier family. Okay? He's not just selling her to pay off debt or get money. He is ensuring for her a better life than he can provide for her himself. Okay? He is giving, this passage clearly shows that he is not just selling his daughter, he is giving her in marriage. Okay? That's why it says she is not to go free as male slaves do. Why? Because she is now the wife of somebody, and obviously marriage is for life. Okay? So there's no 6-year term limit on marriage. So he is, the father is giving her in marriage, and he's offering her for contract service. So this is, you, somebody would have a wife / slave, okay? Okay, so the price for buying a wife / slave would be greater than either of them alone. Just a wife, right, because you have to pay a bride price for a wife, or just a slave, okay? But God gives very specific rules for the woman's protection, okay? So this is not just you sell off your daughter and the family gets to treat her however they want. No, there are very specific rules to protect this daughter, and God gives several ways that she can get out of this if the situation is bad. Okay? A man would want a wife / slave because he would not want to threaten the status of his estate. Okay? If he has a first wife and she has children, those children are going to inherit whatever he has. If he takes a second wife and she's a wife / slave, those children would not inherit. Now, before we think that's horribly unfair, remember that this wife is probably from a very poor family, and she is ensuring for herself and for her children at least financial security, okay, and a better way of life than she would have had at home. So there is benefit to her as well. Just because her kids won't inherit doesn't necessarily mean that this is all bad, okay? God says, if she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself. Okay, so he marries her, and for whatever reason, he doesn't like her. Okay, then he shall let her be redeemed. Okay, so if it goes bad, he doesn't like the woman, she can be redeemed. She can be bought back. There is a way out of this marriage. Okay. Also, if, okay, and then it says, sorry, he does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people. She is not really his. He can't just do with her whatever she wants. She still has to be treated with the respect of a wife. If she's displeasing, then she gets to be redeemed. There is a way out, okay? And it says because of her and his unfairness to her. So it's putting the blame on the master, not on the wife. 9, if he designates her for his son, so he's taking this wife / slave for his son, he shall deal with her how? How's he supposed to treat her?
As his daughter.
As a daughter. She's a wife / slave, but the master needs to treat her like a daughter. Why? Because she has value, she has worth, she's a person. Okay? She is not degraded as a slave. It's, she is being a second wife, because most often this was probably a second wife. Being a second wife didn't make you a second class wife. Okay, you didn't get to be treated differently. God says if you're going to do this, this wife gets treated exactly the same, even if she's a wife / slave. You treat her like a daughter. So she has all the protections that any normal wife would have. She could not, it says, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. So you had to treat her exactly the same you did as a first wife, or if you had one, okay, or any other normal wife. The husband, the son, now being the husband, could not treat her any differently because she was a wife / slave. Okay. If she was not treated equally, 11, if he will not do these 3 things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Okay, so when I first read this, I'm like, what? This sounds like, okay, I don't like my second wife anyway. I'm just going to abandon her by the side of the road with no money. Okay, that's how I read it. That's not what it means. Okay, it means that you have to set her free and she doesn't have to pay you back anything. Okay, remember, there was a bride price for the wife and then a price because she's being sold as a slave. Okay, so this is a higher price. So if you are not going to treat her fairly, then you just let her go and her daddy gets to keep all that money anyway. Okay, she does not she or the family does not have to pay you, the master, anything back. Why? Because you have acted wrongly. You have treated her unfairly. Okay, so she doesn't have to pay whatever amount is remaining on her agreement. Okay, so that's what it means that she goes out for nothing, for without payment of money. It doesn't mean that the master leaves her penniless on the side of the road. Okay, so if you sell your daughter as a wife slash slave and she is not treated fairly, you can either redeem her, or if she is treated very unfairly, then she just gets to walk out scot-free from the marriage and from her service, whatever service she owes to you. Okay, questions about slaves in Israel. Nothing? Just know that these passages are often used to attack God and say God is not fair and God condones slavery. And I think they're very often misinterpreted without seeing God's heart, right? God offered slavery as a way for the poor to better themselves, to get out of poverty, to be taken care of. Okay? So we cannot think of slavery then as slavery today. Nothing? All right. With the help of the Holy Spirit, Joyce, I don't know. Oh, but clearly God allowed him to remember and write it all down. Good question. Anything else? No, I think it was a way out of the marriage. It was a bad marriage. The husband is not being fair to her. Right? I mean, because it says he does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people. Why would God say that? Because that probably is what was done. I have a wife I don't like. She's not pleasing. She doesn't do exactly what I say. What am I going to do? I'm going to just sell her over here. Okay? He couldn't do that. He did not have that kind of authority over her. So she could be redeemed by her family and out of the contract and out of the marriage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Can someone read for me verses 12 through 27?
Strikes his neighbor with a stone or with a fist, if he does not die, but is confined to bed. If he stands and walks about in the outside on his staff, the striker will be unpunished. He will only pay for his inactivity toward his full recovery. And if a man strikes his male slave or female slave with a rod and he dies under his hand, he will surely be avenged. Yet if he survives a day or 2 days, he will not be avenged because he is his money. To 32?
To 27.
And if a man fight and they injure a pregnant woman and her children go out and there is not serious injury, he will surely be fined as a woman's husband demands concerning him and as the judges determine. And if there's a serious injury, he will give life in place of life, eye in place of eye, tooth in place of tooth, hand in place of hand, foot in place of foot, born in burn in place.
place of burn, wound in place of wound, bruise in place of bruise. And if a man strikes the eye of his male slave or the eye of his female slave and destroys it, he shall release him as free in place of his eye. And if he curses the tooth of his male, and if he causes the tooth of his male slave or the tooth of his female slave to fall out, he will release him as free in place of his tooth.
Okay. So, this section and the next section are going to show the priority that God places on life, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So quantitatively, whether you're alive or dead, or qualitatively, you know, if something has happened to injure you to change the quality of your life. Okay? We are going to see that God views everyone as equal. All lives matter. Doesn't matter if you're free, if you're a slave, or even if you are unborn. Okay, we're going to see God cares about your life. Israel was to show to the world that all are equal. And this is very countercultural. Okay, this is not how the ancient Near East viewed the world. Okay, if you diminish a person's life qualitatively or quantitatively, you deserve death or punishment, even if it's a slave. Okay, so it does not matter who it is. All right, so these are all related to command 6, thou shalt not murder. Verse 12 to 14, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will point you a place to which you may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. Okay, so this set of laws protect society from murderers and protects those who kill on accident. So verse 12 is easy. Okay, verse 12 is purposeful homicide. So this is premeditated murder is what this is. And it's just very straightforward. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. Premeditated murder, punishment, you die. And there's no exception. It doesn't matter your class. It doesn't matter your status. It doesn't matter your gender. It doesn't matter your age. You plan to kill somebody, then you die. You plan to kill somebody and kill somebody, then you die. Verse 13 is the exception. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will point you a place to which you are to flee. Okay, so there is accidental or unintentional homicide, where you did not mean to kill this person, it's an accident. In the ancient Near East, it was up to the family of the deceased to avenge the death of their family member. And they did not take into account whether it was intentional or unintentional. So if somebody killed somebody on accident, then that family of the dead person had the right in the ancient to Near East to come and kill you. Okay, even if it was not intentional. So this is a countercultural law. This law also anticipates the cities of refuge. Okay, later on, there are going to be 6 cities that are established. They're spread throughout Israel that are controlled by the Levites. If you remember, the Levites do not get a portion of land. Okay, they're spread all throughout Israel and God gives them cities. Okay, so 6 of these cities are going to be cities of refuge. They offered sanctuary for those who killed on accident. So if you killed someone on accident, you could flee to one of these cities, and then you would wait there until a judge was able to decide your case to determine that, yes, it truly was an accidental murder. Okay? So God here eliminates the idea of blood vengeance. So yes, if somebody lies in wait for you on purpose, kills somebody on purpose, they just deserve to die. If it's an accident, you have to wait until a judge decides and there's a safe place you can go. So it's not automatically the death penalty. Verse 14, if, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. So God is emphasizing there is no, absolutely zero protection for the calculating murderer. Doesn't matter how rich he is. It doesn't matter. Okay? Not even clinging to the horns of the altar. So, in the ancient Near East again, they thought, if a criminal does something or doesn't do something, whatever, and runs and clings to the altar, if the god did not strike him dead there, then it's presumed that he is innocent. Okay? But God says, nuh-uh. If you know this person murdered somebody, cold, calculating, killed in cold blood, it doesn't matter if they're clinging to the horns of my altar. You drag them off of that altar and you execute them. Okay? There is absolutely no protection. There was nowhere a cold-blooded murderer could go to run away from their crimes, the responsibility of their crimes. Okay? Verse 15, he who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Okay? Attacking or assaulting your parents was worthy of death, even if they did not die. Okay? Just says he who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. It doesn't say that they die, necessarily. Okay? But this is not referring to just minor physical abuse, which is not condoned for your parents either, but it also does not require the death penalty. Okay? This is a physical attack that is meant to kill or at least to disable a person and leave them motionless on the floor. So this is a full-on assault. This is more than just a slap in the face. Okay? Parents are protected at a higher level than the general population, at least from their children, okay? Why? They represent God's authority over you, the child, on earth, okay? So you are not allowed to attack or assault your parents. If you do, even if they don't die, it is the death penalty for you, okay? Verse 16, he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. That word kidnaps in the Hebrew is literally steals. And it is the same word that is used in Command 8, thou shalt not steal. Okay, so it literally says he who steals a man. Kidnapping or stealing another person was also a capital crime. And again, there are no exceptions. Typically, this ended up, think Joseph, right, of the kidnapped person being sold into slavery. Okay. So people's freedom from oppression is important to God. So this, we can see from this verse right here, God is 100,000% against the type of slavery that we are familiar with. Okay. You do not steal somebody from where they live, and you do not sell them to somebody else. Also, the slave trader cannot claim innocence, right? Because even if you are just found in possession of a stolen person, you die. So the person who steals dies, and the person who has the stolen person dies. Okay? God is totally 100% against this kind of slavery, where you are stealing someone and selling them to be owned by somebody else for the rest of their life. Verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Okay, this curse is more than just saying, I wish you were dead in anger. Okay, this is more than just being angry at your parents. This would be publicly and perhaps by an oath assert that you never want to have anything to do with your parents and you will not respect or serve them any longer and you wish only harm for them. This would also mean that you are not going to take care of your parents when they get older. Okay? So if you have totally rejected your parents' authority to this level, you will not take care of them, you will have nothing to do with them, you hate them, you want only harm for them, that is also a capital offense. This is also emphasized again in Leviticus 20, verse 9, and also in Proverbs 20:20. Okay, you could not curse your parents. So we can see from these passages, parents are protected on a whole nother level, at least from their children. Okay.
Can you see those verses again?
Yes, Leviticus 20, verse 9, and Proverbs 20, verse 20. Leviticus 20, verse 9, and Proverbs 20, 20. Okay. Verse 18 and 19. If men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed. If he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. Okay, so this is, there's a fight. A fight breaks out, and somebody gets injured either by hand or fist or foot, or some sort of object. Okay, the person who is injured cannot claim more than the cost to recover and the loss of time being out of work. Okay, so medical bills and whatever money you didn't earn because you couldn't work. God allows no room for our common practice of damages for pain and suffering. You know, we'll have a case, whatever, where the medical bills are so much, but then the court awards damages of millions of dollars. Okay, God did not allow for that. As long as, there's a caveat, right? As long as he can get up and walk around a little bit and he eventually is fully healed. The end of verse 19, he has to take care of him until he is completely healed. Okay. The logic behind this is if you choose to fight, right? If you can't control your temper and you choose to fight, you take the risk of injury. Okay. And you can't expect anything more than medical bills and lost time. That's all that the punishment is going to be. Verse 20 and 21. If a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Okay, these verses have also grossly been misunderstood. Ironically, even though it maybe not doesn't seem it in the English, this law shows that slaves are equal to everyone else. Okay, corporal punishment was allowed for children and for slaves. The rod, when it says if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod, represents corporal punishment, and this could be anything from a slap to caning, okay? But this law limits how far the punishment can go. Presumably, the slave is being punished for a very serious crime like stealing from his master, okay? But the employer or the master could not beat his slave so severely that he either caused permanent injury, we'll see that later, or death. So there is a limit. If the servant dies, it is murder. It says, if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hands, he shall be punished. Guess what? Guess what that punishment would be?
Death.
Exactly. You kill your slave, you deserve to die. Why? Because your slave is a person too. Your slave matters. All right? If the servant, and this is the part that it, I think, at least when I read it, I misunderstand it. Okay? It says, if, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. When I read this, I read it as, okay, you beat a slave so bad that he's on death's doorstep. But he lives a day or two. Well, he lives a day or two, then that's okay. You get off scot-free. You've just lost a slave. Okay? Some people do interpret it that way. But I think, and the commentary I read agree, well, this is where I got the idea, was that if the servant loses a day or two and then gets up and is fine, so he had a bad beating, but he's just down and out for a day or two, there is no vengeance, okay? You don't owe your slave a day or two's worth of money. Why? Because you own the slave, and the slave is the one that owes you money. So you have already been punished by losing a day or two of the slave's work, okay? If you beat your slave so badly he can't work for a couple days, well, now you've lost those days as the employer, and you had to do the extra work, or somebody else has to do the extra work, so you've already been punished that way. Okay, so it does not mean that if the slave just lives a day or two and then dies, then you get to walk off scot-free. Okay, it means death. If the slave dies, period, you are a murderer and you die. Okay, but if the slave is just hurt, like in the passage right before it, right? If he gets up and walks on his staff, right? If you're a free man, then you're owed medical bills and time lost. If you're a slave, your master's already paying your medical bills, right? And the time lost is already a loss to your master. So he has already, in essence, done the same thing as the prior verse. Does that make sense? Okay? Because we're going to see if you're permanently injured as a slave, it's grounds for release. It's grounds for freedom. We're going to see that in verse 26 to 27. Okay? So the employer cannot beat his slave unfairly or so severely and get off without penalty. The master will be punished. Why? Slaves' lives are equal to everybody else's lives. Verse 22. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. Okay? Now, when it says she gives birth prematurely, that phrase is actually really difficult in the Hebrew to translate. And it could mean she is still able to have children. Okay, which is very different than she gives birth prematurely. Okay, but regardless, the idea behind this law is, it addresses hitting a pregnant woman where she may or may not suffer a permanent injury related to her ability to have children, and she may or may not, and her unborn baby may or may not suffer injury. Okay, so the interesting thing about this law is if you hit a pregnant woman, you are guilty and you have to pay regardless of whether you cause any injury or not. The woman might be fine, the baby might be fine, and you still have to pay. Okay, now it's going to get more and more severe if the woman's not fine or the baby's not fine. So the husband and the judges get to decide what this penalty is. If two men's fighting gets so out of control that a pregnant woman is hit, God thinks that's inexcusable. Okay? It seems like the punishment would be set after the baby is born just to ensure that there is what harm was done to the baby or if there was harm done to the baby at all. Okay? The husband could prosecute this case even if there was no harm to his wife or to his baby, simply for the risk and anxiety of facing the possibility of injury to his wife or to his baby. Okay, so this is one case where you kind of do get pain and suffering. Okay, but it only relates to a pregnant woman. If you hit her, you are liable for something that the judges are going to decide based on the severity of whatever happened. Okay, why? Because whose life matters here? That's right. Both the baby and the woman, okay? But here we see God's care for the unborn baby, where if you hit a pregnant woman, you are punished even if the baby is fine, okay? Even if there is no problem with the baby. You do not even begin to harm the life of an unborn baby by hitting his mother, okay? Verse 23 to 25. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Okay? So if either mom or baby is injured, the penalty matches the severity of the injury. Life for life. Okay? If you cause that baby to die, guess what? You die. Okay, why? Because the unborn baby is still as much of a person as the slave, as the free man. Everybody's life is equal. This is the first talion law in scripture. Talion, T-A-L-I-O-N. It means tooth in Latin. Comes from eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Okay, and it's this tit for tat kind of law. You do this, you get the same thing done for you. This law establishes the general principle for dealing with various permanent injuries. Okay? When a person is maimed through your doing, a mere monetary penalty is not sufficient. Okay? So God is prohibiting buying your way out of a crime. Okay? But on the flip side, we have no evidence that this law was taken literally. Like, literally, if the eye was put out, then your eye was poked out. Okay? The only part that was taken literally that we're sure of is life for life, but that has already been established. God has already said that. If you kill someone, you deserve to die. But the penalty was supposed to hurt the perpetrator as much as if his eye was put out or his whatever, bruise or whatever, okay? The precise penalty was left to the judges, and it could be banishment, loss of property, corporal punishment, public humiliation, etc., etc. Whatever is going to hurt this person like the person they were hurt, that they hurt, okay? The goal here is to see that justice is done, that full justice is done, and that you can't just hurt someone and walk away scot-free. Verse 26 and 27. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. Okay? So, unlike the customs of the ancient Near East, God valued human rights more than employer rights. Okay, so here we see that the slave is very valuable to God. If the master diminishes the quality of life of the slave, even knocking out a tooth, I mean, a lot of people would think a tooth, an eye, okay. A tooth, you can get along without one tooth just fine. Okay? But if the quality of life of a slave has been diminished, what does the master have to do?
You have to let him go free.
You have to let him go free, right? Presumably without the slave having to pay back the rest of his contract. So now the master has lost big time. Because now he doesn't have a worker. He's lost all that money. Now he has to go out and pay someone else a full contract, again, to take his place. Okay? So, even for a tooth. So, we see here that the master's rule is not absolute. The owner's lost the labor of the servant. That is his punishment. And that's an expensive punishment based on how long you've had your slave. Okay, judges could then extrapolate from this general law to determine the appropriate punishment, right? Because let's say you have 2 days left on your contract, okay? The master can't then decide to beat you senseless and knock out all your teeth, right? And, oh, I'm only losing 2 days' work. It's not that big a deal. No, they would extrapolate from this general law to rule on specific circumstances. This kept the master in check and did not allow corporal punishment to get out of hand. Okay, so yes, you were allowed to punish your slave, but it could not be excessive. You could not kill him, and you could not permanently injure him. It was not allowed. Questions on this section? All right. Can someone read for me verse 28 through 36?
When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable. But if the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has been warned but has not kept it in, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is imposed on him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is imposed on him. If it gores a man's son or daughter, he shall be dealt with according to the same rule. If the ox gores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his. When one man's ox butts another, so then it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price. And the and the dead beast also they shall share. Or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past, and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his.
Okay, so verse 28 through 32, what happens if your animal kills someone? The principle here is that owners are responsible for their animals. Okay. During this time period, everyone farmed to some extent, so everyone owned animals or had need of animals, would need to rent them. Okay. If this law was given today, it would probably deal with vehicles and traffic accidents. Okay, what happens if your car kills someone? All right. So the ox or the bull is used in this example, but this again would apply to injuries by any animal. Okay, you could not argue in court, well, it was my donkey and not my ox, so it doesn't apply. No, didn't work that way. So we have three situations here. Situation one, verse 28, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. Okay, so here you have an ox that kills someone. This is not normal behavior for an ox. It's not like ox go out and kill people all the time. Okay, so the logic behind this law is that there's no reasonable way that the owner could foresee this happening. Okay, it's an accident. Oxen are live creatures. They have, you know, somewhat of their own will. All right. So it gets provoked somehow. It kills somehow. It's never done this before. The owner had no idea that his oxen was going to do this. So what do we do? So God holds the owner not responsible. Now, in a certain way, yes, the owner is responsible in that the ox dies. Okay. And that is going to be a big financial loss to the owner. Oxen were very expensive. Bulls are expensive even today. Okay. So the ox died and the owner could not even eat his meat. Okay, so it's not like he got something out of it at the end. No, the oxen is killed and his meat goes to waste. That is a big financial loss to the owner, but the owner does not lose his life because he could not have guessed that his animal would do this. Okay, situation two. Verse 29, if, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. Okay, so in this scenario, the ox is known to be dangerous. Maybe it has tried to gore somebody before. Something's wrong with this animal. It hasn't successfully killed anyone yet, all right? But the owner knows that this animal is dangerous. If the owner doesn't do anything about it, then he is now responsible for the death of the person that the ox gored, as if he killed that person. So the ox is put to death and he is put to death. Okay. Situation three, verse 30, if a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Okay. So this is not a contradiction of the prior verse. This is basically saying if the case is complicated, for example, if the ox was dangerous years ago, but has been shown no signs of aggression since, and it's been years and years, okay, let's say the owner loaned out the ox to someone else with a warning saying, hey, you got to be careful because, you know, this happened years and years ago. Then the ox is provoked on purpose and gores someone, right? Then it's a little more complicated. It's not so straightforward as the owner has been negligent or not cares and hasn't warned anyone. Okay. This gives the judge leeway to decide a fine. Okay. So if the judge determines that, hey, the owner did everything he was supposed to, he warned, he did blah, 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 but you know, the boys down the street decide to throw stones and pick a fight with the ox, right? Maybe the owner is not so responsible for this. Okay. So maybe this gives the judge leeway to decide if a fine is more appropriate of a punishment than a penalty. Okay. The judge and the family of the deceased would work together to come up with a fine and the owner would then pay it. OK, Okay? This was a redemption payment. The owner was redeeming his own life from death. Okay? Because technically the base law is if your ox has been dangerous in the past and it kills someone, then you die. Okay? But God is allowing for, yes, there are complications. Not every case is so straightforward. It might not have been the owner's full fault. Okay? I mean, let's say the owner had the ox all penned up and some boy jumped the fence and threw, you know, stones at the ox. Well, is that really the owner's fault? You know, he had done his job and the boy shouldn't have done that. So God gives leeway for complicated situations. Verse 31, whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver and the ox shall be stoned. Okay? So these same principles apply to children and slaves or servants. God values all life. The life of a child is just as valuable as the life of an adult. Okay? Servants, however, are slightly different just because of their... what they're doing, okay? You have to think of this in terms of the military, okay? Just like our military, just like the men in our military can be ordered into harm's way, slaves could be ordered into harm's way, okay? If your lieutenant says, go fight in this battle, you have no choice. You go, okay? So just like in our military, if a lieutenant orders a private into harm's way and the private dies, the lieutenant is not punished. Okay, even if the lieutenant acted wrongly, shouldn't have made that call or whatever, okay? The lieutenant is not, I mean, there might be some ramifications depending on how wrongly the lieutenant acted. However, joining the military comes with inherent risks, right? Entering into slavery came with some inherent risks, right? You agreed to do what your master said. Your master says work with this bull or ox, you had to work with that bull or ox. Okay, so the idea here is that if a slave gets gored by an ox, whose fault is it really? Is it the owner of the ox, because maybe the ox is rented, or is it the owner of the slave? Should the owner of the slave really have ordered their slave to work with that ox? You know, so there's culpability on possibly both sides. It's not necessarily just the owner of the ox. Okay, but, okay, there is still a punishment to the owner of the ox. The owner of the ox has to pay 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So the ox dies, period. Even if it's they just kill a slave, the ox dies. 30 shekels of silver, okay? This is enough to buy a very good piece of property. Think, this is like $1 million, okay, this is a hefty fine. This is not just $30 or $10. So the life of a slave is very valuable. Okay? You could not, the owner of the ox could not say, well, the slave only owes you this much more on their contract, so I'm only going to pay you that much more to make up the value of the slave. No, God sets the price at 30 shekels of silver, which is a significant amount of money. Okay? And what should, especially this time of year, 30 shekels of silver remind us of? Right. What Judas was paid for to deny Christ. Now, remember, what was that 30 shekels of silver used for? To buy a potter's field. It is enough to buy a very good piece of land. Okay? So Jesus was sold for this price that a slave was deemed at, right? But this is not an insignificant amount of money. This is a significant amount of money. Okay? So slaves are equal to everybody else. Okay? The reason the owner of the ox does not die is because, again, the owner of the slave shares some responsibility in the death of the slave, okay? Okay, but remember, all this is open to the judge to judge each situation, okay? If the owner of the ox purposefully set loose a dangerous ox on somebody else's slave purposefully, then that's going to be judged as murder, and the owner of the ox is going to die. Okay, so these laws also allow the judge to judge each specific situation. It's when the details get a little murky and a little more complicated, okay? But it's left up to the judge's discretion. Okay, so these laws really show God values the life of a slave and God values the life of the unborn just as much as he values anybody else's life. Verse 33-34. If a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. Okay? These laws are about liability for causing the death of an animal by negligence. All right? Animals sometimes wander, right? But the owner of the animal maybe should keep his animals penned in. Okay, so it's partly the owner of the animal's responsibility that his animal was wandering near the farm of another person who had an open pit. But at the same time, the owner of the farm shouldn't have an open pit. So the owner of the pit just pays enough to replace the animal, and then the dead animal becomes his, right? So he can eat the meat if it's a clean animal that he can eat. Verse 35 and 36. If one man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his. Okay, so this is when an animal causes the death of another animal. Okay, verse 35 addresses when this could not be anticipated. Two animals get in a fight, and one of them dies. When this happened, both animals are quote-unquote liquidated. Okay, so you have to sell the live animal and then split that money and then split the meat of the dead animal. Okay, with animals, there is no easy way to tell which animal was really at fault. Maybe the dead animal was the one that provoked the other animal, right, and then just ended up dead. It's hard. You can't know. You can't talk to animals, right? You don't know what happened. So that's why they just split things evenly. Okay, but verse 36, if the bull, the ox or the bull is dangerous and known to be dangerous, then the owner of the dead ox gets the price of a new one so he can go out and replace his animal, but then the dead ox belongs to the guy whose ox killed him. Okay, so God is just making it fair so that the owner of the dead ox, he gets to go buy a brand new ox. And it's like he's put in a place where this never happened. Okay, and then the dead ox becomes the owner of the killer's ox to eat the meat.